Perhaps once there had been Aes Sedai who could, say, hurl a ball of fire without some sort of throwing motion, but if so, they were long dead, and their teachings with them. Today, some things just could not be done without the appropriate gestures. There were sisters who claimed they could tell who had taught another sister by which motions she used for which weaves. "Teaching any of our new apprentices anything has been difficult at best," Sorelia went on. "I do not speak to offend, but you Aes Sedai give oath, it seems, and immediately try to find a way around it. Alana Mosvani is particularly difficult." Suddenly her clear green eyes were very sharp on Cudswain's face. "How can we punish her willful failings if it means harming the Karakarn?" Cudswain folded her hands in her lap. Masking surprise was not easy, so much for the secret of Alana's crime. But why had the woman let her know that she knew? Perhaps one revelation called for another. "The bond does not work in that fashion," she said. "If you kill her, he will die then or soon after. Short of that, he will be aware of what happens to her, but he will not really feel it. As far away as he is now, he will only be vaguely aware at that." Sorelia nodded slowly. Her fingers touched the golden tray on the table, then came away. Her expression was as hard to read as the face of a statue, but Cadzowain suspected that Alana would find an unpleasant surprise the next time she let her temper flare, or threw one of her Arafelin sulks. That was unimportant, though. Only the boy was important. "Most men will take what is offered if it seems attractive and pleasant," Sorelia said. "Once we thought of Randall Thor so. Unfortunately, it is too late to change the path we walk. Now he suspects whatever is offered freely. Now, if I wanted him to accept something, I would pretend I did not want him to have it. If I wanted to stay close to him, I would pretend indifference to whether I ever saw him again." Once more those eyes focused on Cadzwain, green augurs, not trying to see what lay inside her head. The woman knew. Some, at least. Enough or too much. Still, Cadzwain felt a rising thrill of possibility. If she had had any doubts that Sorelia wanted to feel her out, they were gone. And you did not feel out someone in this manner unless you hoped for some agreement. "Do you believe a man must be hard?" she asked. She was taking a chance. "Or strong?" By her tone, she left no doubt she saw a difference. Again Sorelia touched the tray. The smallest of smiles might have quirked her lips for an instant. Or not. "Most men see the two as one and the same," Cadzwain Maladrin. "Strong endures. Hard shatters." Cadzwain drew breath. A chance she would have scoured anyone else for taking. But she was not anyone else, and sometimes chances had to be taken. "The boy confuses them," she said. "He needs to be strong and makes himself harder. Too hard already, and he will not stop until he is stopped. He has forgotten how to laugh except in bitterness. There are no tears left in him. Unless he finds laughter and tears again, the world faces disaster. He must learn that even the dragon reborn is flesh. If he goes to Tarmogaidin as he is, even his victory may be as dark as his defeat." Sorelia listened intently and kept silent even after Cadzwain finished. Those green eyes studied her. "Your dragon reborn and your last battle are not in our prophecies," Sorelia said at last. "We have tried to make Randall Thor know his blood, but I fear he sees us as only another spear. If one spear breaks in your hand, you do not pause to mourn before taking up another. Perhaps you and I aim at targets not too far apart." "Perhaps we do," Cadzwain said cautiously. "Targets even a hand apart might be not at all alike." Abruptly the glow of Sidar surrounded the leather-faced woman. She was weak enough to make Daigyan look at least moderately strong, but then Sorelia's strength did not lie in the power. "There is a thing you may find useful," she said. "I cannot make it work, but I can weave the flows to show you." She did just that, laying feeble skeins that fell into place and melted, too poor to do what they were intended for. "It is called traveling," Sorelia said. This time Cadzwain's jaw dropped. Alana and Kiruna and the rest denied teaching the Wise Ones how to link, or a number of other skills they suddenly seemed to have, and Cadswain had assumed the Aiel had managed to wring them out of the sisters held in the tents. But this was impossible, she would have said. Yet she did not believe Sorelia was lying. She could hardly wait to try the weave herself. Not that it was of much use immediately. Even if she knew exactly where the wretched boy was, she had to make him come to her. Sorelia was right about that. "A very great gift," she said slowly. "I have nothing I can give you to compare." This time there was no doubt of the brief smile that flashed across Sorelia's lips. She knew very well that Cadswain was in her debt. Taking up the heavy golden pitcher with both hands, she carefully filled the small white cups with plain water. She did not spill a drop. "I offer you water oath," she said solemnly, picking up one of the cups. "By this we are bound as one to teach Randall Thor laughter and tears." She sipped, and Cadswain imitated her. "We are bound as one." "And if their targets turned out not to be the same at all?" She did not underestimate Sorelia as ally or opponent, but Cadswain knew which target had to be struck at any cost.
Chapter 13 Floating Like Snow. The northern horizon was purple with the fierce rain that had hammered the east of Ilion through the night. Overhead, a morning sky of dark boiling clouds threatened, and strong winds flung cloaks about, made banners snap and crack like whips on the crest of the ridge. The white dragon banner and the crimson banner of light, and the bright standards of nobility from Ilion and Cairhien and Tyr. The nobles kept to their own kind, three widely spaced knots, awash in gilt and silver-plated steel, silks and velvets and laces, but in common they looked around uneasily. Even the best-trained of their horses tossed heads and stamped hooves on the muddy ground. The wind was cold, and colder seeming for the heat it had replaced so abruptly, just as the rain had been a shock after so long without. From whatever nation they had prayed for the baking drought to break, but none knew what to make of unrelenting storms in answer to their prayers. Some glanced at Rand when they thought he would not notice, perhaps wondering if he had answered them so. The thought made him laugh softly, bitterly. He patted his black gelding's neck with a leather-gauntleted hand, glad that Tai-Tai-Shar did not show nerves. The massive animal might have been a statue, awaiting the pressure of reins or knees to move. It was good that the Dragon Reborn's horse seemed as cold as he did, as though they floated in the void together. Even with the one power raging through him, fire and ice and death, he was barely aware of the wind, though it flailed his gold-embroidered cloak about and cut through his coat, green silk thickly worked with gold, and not intended for wear in such weather. The wounds in his side ached and throbbed, the old and the new cutting across it, the wounds that would never heal, but that was distant too, another man's flesh. The crown of swords might have been pricking someone else's temples with the sharp points of the tiny blades among its golden laurel leaves. Even the filth woven through Saiyadin seemed less obtrusive than it once had, still vile, still loathsome, but no longer worth notice. The noble's eyes on his back were palpable, though. Shifting his sword hilt, he leaned forward. He could see the tight cluster of low wooded hills half a mile to the east as clearly as if he were using a looking glass. The land was flat here, the only prominences those forested hills and this long ridge thrusting up from the heath. The next thicket, dense enough to truly deserve the name, lay close to 10 miles off. Only storm-battered half-leafless trees and tangles of undergrowth were visible on the hills, but he knew what they hid. 2, perhaps 3,000 of the men Samael had gathered to try to stop him from taking Ilion. That army had disintegrated once they learned that the man who had summoned them was dead, that Matin Stepanaeus had vanished, perhaps into the grave as well, and that there was a new king in Ilion. Many had scattered back to their homes, yet just as many clung together. Usually no more than 20 here, 30 there, but a great army if they came together again, and countless armed bands otherwise. Either way, they could not be allowed to roam the countryside. Time weighed down on his shoulders like lead. There was never enough time, but maybe this once. Fire and ice and death. What would you do, he thought. Are you there? And then, doubtfully, hating the doubt, were you ever there? Silence answered, deep and dead in the emptiness that surrounded him. Or was there mad laughter somewhere in the recesses of his mind? Did he imagine it, like the feel of someone looking over his shoulder, someone just on the brink of touching his back? Or the colors that swirled just out of sight, more than colors, and were gone? A thing of madmen. His gloved thumb slid along the carvings that serpentined the dragon scepter. The long green and white tassels below the polished spear point fluttered in the wind. Fire and ice and death would come. "I will go talk to them myself," he announced, which produced a furor. Lord Gregorin, the green sash of the Council of Nine slanted across his ornately gilded breastplate, hurried his fine-ankled white gelding forward from the Ilioners, followed closely by Dmitri Markolin, first captain of the Companions, on a solid bay. Markolin was the only man among them without silk or a speck of lace, the only man in plain, if brightly burnished armor, though the conical helmet resting on his saddle's high pommel did bear three thin golden plumes. Lord Marek lifted his reins, then let them fall uncertainly when he saw no others of the Nine move. A wide man with a stolid manner, and new to the council, he often seemed more craftsman than lord, despite the rich silks beneath his lavish armor and the folds of lace spilling over. High Lords Wyraman and Tolmeron, spurred together from the Tyrans, as crusted with gold and silver as any of the Nine, and Rosanna, newly raised to High Lady and wearing a breastplate, worked with the hawk and stars of her house. There, too, others half made as if to follow, then hung back, looking worried. Blade-slender Aracom and blue-eyed Marakan and bald-headed Guayam were dead men. They did not know that, but however much they wanted to be at the center of power, they feared Rand would kill them. Only Lord Samaradrid came from the Kyrianen on a gray that had seen better days, his armor battered, its gilding chipped. His face was gaunt and hard, the front of his head shaved and powdered like a common soldier, and his dark eyes shone with contempt for the taller Tyrans. There was plenty of contempt to go around. Tyrans and Kyrianen hated one another. Ilioners and Tyrans despised each other. Only Kyrianen and Ilioners got along to any degree, and there was a certain amount of prickle even there. Their two nations might not have near the long history of bad blood shared by Tyr and Ilion, yet the Kyrianen still were foreigners, armed and armored on Ilion's soil, welcomed half-heartedly at best, and only that much because they followed Rand. But despite all the frowning and bristling and trying to talk at once as they milled about Rand in a flurry of wind-blown cloaks, they had a common goal now, after a fashion. "Majesty," Gregorin said hastily, bowing in his gold-tooled saddle, "I do beg you let me go in your stead, or first Captain Markolin." The square-cut beard that left his upper lip bare framed a round face, creased with worry. "These men must know you are a king. The proclamations do be read in every village, at every crossroads, as we do speak. Yet they may not show proper respect for your crown." Lantern-jawed Markolin, clean-shaven, studied Rand with dark, deep-set eyes, giving no hint what lay behind his impassive face. The Companion's loyalty was to the crown of Ilion, and Markolin was old enough to remember when Tam-Ulthor had been second captain over him. But only he knew what he thought of Rand-Ulthor as king. "My lord dragon," Wyraman intoned as he made his bow, not waiting for Gregorin to finish. The man always intoned, and even on horseback he seemed to strut. His worked velvets and striped silks and falls of lace almost overwhelmed his armor, and his pointed gray beard gave off a flowery scent of perfumed oils. "This rabble is too petty to concern the Lord Dragon personally. Set dogs to catch dogs, I say. Let the Ilioners root them out. Burn my soul, they've done nothing so far to serve you but talk."
Trust him to turn agreement with Gregorin into an insult. Tolmeron was lean enough to make Wyraman appear bulky, and somber enough to dim the luster of his garb. He was no fool, and rival to Wyraman besides. Yet he nodded slowly in agreement. No love lost there for Ilioners at all. Samaradrid curled a lip at the Tyrans, but addressed himself to Rand, cutting in hard in Wyraman's heels. "This gathering is 10 times as large as any other we have found so far, my lord dragon,"
He cared nothing for the King of Ilion, and little enough for the Dragon Reborn, except that the throne of Cairhien was Rand's to give, and Samaradrid hoped it would be given to one he could follow instead of fight.
"Their loyalties must be to Brend, or so many would not have held together. I fear talking to them is a waste of time, but if you must talk, let me ring their position openly with steel so they know the price of putting a foot out of line."
Rosanna glared right back at Samaradrid. A lean woman, not tall, yet nearly as tall as he, with eyes like blue ice. She did not wait for him to finish either, and she too spoke to Rand.
"I've come too far, and invested too much in you to see you die now for nothing," she said bluntly.
No more a fool than Tomeran. Rosanna had claimed a place in the councils of the High Lords, though Tyran High Ladies seldom did, and blunt was the word for her. Despite the armor most of the noble women wore, none actually led their armsmen into battle, yet Rosanna carried a flanged mace on her saddle, and sometimes Rand thought she would like a chance to use it.
"I doubt those Ilioners lack for bows," she said, "and it takes only one arrow to kill even the dragon reborn."
Pursing his lips thoughtfully, Markalin nodded before catching himself, then exchanged startled looks with Rosanna, each more surprised than the other to find themselves of like mind with an ancient enemy.
"These peasants could never have found the mettle to stay under arms without encouragement,"
Wireman continued smoothly, ignoring Rosanna. He was skilled at ignoring who and what. He did not want to see or hear. He was a fool.
"May I suggest, my Lord Dragon, look to these so-called Nine for the source?" "I do protest this tyrant pig's insults, Majesty,"
Gregorin growled right atop him, one hand darting for his sword.
"I do protest most heartily."
"There are too many this time," Samaradrid said at the same instant. "Most will turn against you as soon as your back is to them in any case." By his pointed frown, he might have been speaking of the Tyrens as well as the men on the wooded hills. Perhaps he was.
"Better to kill them and be done." "Did I ask for opinions?" Rand snapped harshly.
Babel became silence, except for the crack of cloaks and banners flapping in the wind. Suddenly expressionless faces regarded him, more than one going gray. They did not know he held the power, but they knew him. Not all of what they knew was truth, but it was just as well they believed.
"You will come with me, Gregorin,"
he said in a more normal voice. Still hard, though. Steel was all they understood. Go soft, and they would turn on him.
"And you, Markalin. The rest stay here. Dasheva! Hopwill!"
Everyone not named reined their horses back hurriedly as the Tuashiman rode to join Rand, and the Ilioners eyed the black-coated men as though they would have liked to remain behind, too. Aside from anything else, Corlin Dasheva was glowering and muttering under his breath, as he so often did. Everyone was aware that Saidin drove men mad sooner or later, and plain-faced Dasheva certainly looked the part, lank, untrimmed hair flying in the wind, licking his lips and shaking his head. For that matter, Eben Hopwill, just 16 and still with a few scattered blotches on his cheeks, wore a staring frown that gazed beyond anything in sight. At least Rand knew the why of that. As the Ashaman drew near, Rand could not help cocking his head to listen, though what he listened for was inside his head. Alana was there, of course. Neither the void nor the power altered that a whisker. Distance wore that awareness down to just that— awareness that she existed, somewhere far to the north. Yet there was something more today, something he had felt several times recently, dim and barely on the edge of notice. A whisper of shock, perhaps, or outrage, a breath of something sharp he could not quite grasp. She must feel whatever it was very strongly for him to be even that conscious of it at this distance. Maybe she was missing him. A wry thought. He did not miss her. Ignoring Alana was easier than it had been once. She was there, but not the voice that used to shout of death and killing whenever an Ashaman came into sight. Luz Theron was gone. Unless that feel of someone staring at the back of his head, brushing his shoulder blades with a finger, was him. Was there a madman's hoarse laughter deep in his thoughts? Or was it his own? The man had been there. He had. He became aware of Markalin staring at him, and Gregorin trying very hard not to. "Not yet," he told them wryly, and almost laughed when they clearly understood right away. Relief was too plain on their faces for anything else. He was not insane. Yet. "Come," he told them, and started Tidashar down the slope at a trot. Despite the men following, he felt alone. Despite the power, he felt empty. Between the ridge and the hills lay patches of thick scrub and long stretches of dead grass, a glistening mat of brown and yellow, beaten flat by the rain. Only a few days ago, the ground had been so parched that he had thought it could drink a river without changing. Then the torrents came, sent by the Creator finding mercy at last, or maybe by the Dark One in a fit of black humor. He did not know which. Now the horse's hooves splashed mud at every second step. He hoped this did not take long. He had some time, by what Hopwell had reported, but not forever. Perhaps weeks if he was lucky. He needed months. Light he needed years he would never have. His hearing heightened by the power, he could make out some of what the men behind him were saying. Gregorin and Markelin rode knee to knee, trying to hold their cloaks against the wind, and speaking in low tones about the men ahead, about their fears the men might fight. Neither doubted they would be crushed if they resisted, but they feared the effect on Rand, and his on Ilion, if Ilioners fought him now that Brend was dead. They still could not bring themselves to give Brend his true name, Samael. The very notion that one of the Forsaken had ruled in Ilion frightened them, even more than the fact that the Dragon Reborn ruled there now. Dashiva, slumped in his gray's saddle like a man who had never seen a horse before, muttered angrily under his breath, in the old tongue, which he spoke and read as fluently as a scholar. Rand knew a little, though not enough to understand what the fellow was mumbling. Probably complaints about the weather. Despite being a farmer, Dashiva disliked being out of doors unless the skies were clear. Only Hopwill rode in silence, frowning at something beyond the horizon, his hair and cloak whipping about as wildly as Dashiva's. Now and then he clutched the hilt of his sword unconsciously. Rand had to speak three times, the last sharply, before Hopwill gave a surprised jerk and booted his lanky dun up beside Tidashar. Rand studied him. The young man, not a boy any longer, no matter his age, had filled out since Rand first saw him, though his nose and ears still seemed made for a bigger man. A dragon, red-enameled gold, now balanced the silver sword on his high collar, just like Dashiva's. Once he had said he would laugh a year for joy when the dragon was his, but he stared unblinking at Rand as though looking through him. "What you learned was good news," Rand told him. Only an effort kept him from trying to crush the dragon's scepter in his fist. "You did well." He had expected the Shan Chan to return, but not so soon. He had hoped not so soon. And not leaping out of nowhere, swallowing cities at a gulp. When he found out that merchants in Ilion had known for days before any of them thought to inform the Nine, the Light forbid they should lose a chance at profit because too many knew too much. He had been within a hair of scouring the city to its foundations. But the news was good, or as good as it could be in the circumstances. Hopwill had traveled to Amador, to the countryside nearby, and the Shan Chan appeared to be waiting, perhaps digesting what they had consumed. The Light said they choked on it. He forced his grip to loosen on the length of dragon-carved spearhead. "If more brings half as good, I have time to settle Ilion before dealing with them. Ebu Dar as well. The Light burn the Shan Chan. They were a distraction, one he did not need and could not afford to ignore." Hopwill said nothing, only looked. "Are you upset because you had to kill women? Desura of the Musara Rain, and Lamella of the Smokewater Miyagoma, and—" Rand forced down the instinctive litany even as it began floating across the void. New names had appeared on that list, names he did not remember adding. Ligan Arnold, a Red Sister, who had died trying to take him a prisoner to Tarvalin. Surely she had no right to a place, but she had claimed one. Kolaver Saigan, who had hanged herself rather than accept justice. Others. Men had died in thousands, by his order or by his hand, but it was the faces of the women that haunted his dreams. Each night he made himself confront their silently accusing eyes. Maybe it was their eyes he had felt of late. "I told you about Damani and Suldam," he said calmly, but inside of him, Rage flared, fire spider-webbing around the emptiness of the void.
The light burned me. I killed more women than all your nightmares could hold. My hands are black with the blood of women.
If you hadn't wiped out that Shonchan patrol, they'd have killed you for sure. He did not say that Hopwell should have avoided them, avoided the need to kill them. Too late for that. I doubt that Damani even knew how to shield a man. You had no choice. And better they were all dead than some escaping with word of a man who could channel scouting them. Absently, Hopwell touched his left sleeve, where the black color disguised fire-scarred wool. The Shonchan had not died easily or fast.
I piled the bodies in a hollow, he said in a flat voice. The horses, everything. I burned it all to ash. White ash that floated in the wind like snow. It didn't bother me at all.
Rand heard the lie in the man's tongue, but Hopwell had to learn. After all, he had. They were what they were, and that was all there was to it. All there was. Laya of the Cursita Charin, a name written in fire. Moraine Damodred, another name that seared to the soul rather than merely burning. A nameless dark friend, represented only by a face, who had died by his sword near.
"Majesty," Gregorin said loudly, pointing ahead.
A lone man came out of the trees at the foot of the nearest hill to stand waiting in an attitude of defiance. He carried a bow and wore a pointed steel cap and a belted mail shirt that hung nearly to his knees. Rand spurred Tadashar to meet him, seething with the power. Sidin could protect him from men. Up close, the bowman did not make so brave a sight. Rust streaked his helmet and mail, and he looked sodden, mud to his thighs, damp hair trailing down a narrow face. Coughing hollowly, he scrubbed at a long nose with the back of his hand. His bowstring appeared taut, though. That he had protected from the rain. And the fletching on the arrows in his quiver looked dry, too.
"Are you the leader here?" Rand demanded. "You might say I do speak for him," the narrow-faced man replied warily. "Why?"
As the others galloped up behind Rand, he shifted his feet, dark eyes like a cornered badger's. Badgers were dangerous, cornered.
"Watch your tongue, man," Gregorin snapped. "You do speak to Randall Thor, the dragon reborn, lord of the morning and king of Ilion. Kneel to your king. What do your name be?"
"He do be the dragon reborn," the fellow said doubtfully.
Eyeing Rand from the crown on his head to his boots, lingering a moment on the gilded dragon buckling his sword belt, the man shook his head as if he had expected someone older or grander.
"And lord of the morning, you do say? Our king did never style himself so."
He made no move toward kneeling or giving his name. Gregorin's face darkened at the man's tone, and maybe at the man's oblique denial of Rand as king. Marklin gave a slight nod, as though he had expected no more. Damp rustlings stirred in the undergrowth among the trees. Rand heard easily, and abruptly he felt Sidene fill Hopwell. No longer staring at nothing, Hopwell studied the woodline intently, a wild light in his eyes. Dasheva, silent, raking dark hair out of his face, looked bored. Leaning forward in his saddle, Gregorin opened his mouth angrily. Fire and ice, but not yet death.
"Peace, Gregorin."
Rand did not raise his voice, but he wove flows to carry his words, air and fire, so they boomed against the wall of trees.
"My offer is generous."
The long-nosed man staggered at the sound, and Gregorin's horse shied. Those hidden men would hear clearly.
"Lay down your arms, and those who want to return home can. Those who want to follow me instead can do that. But no man leaves here under arms unless he does follow me. I know most of you are good men who answered the call of your king and the Council of Nine to defend Ilion. But I am your king now, and I'll not have anyone tempted to turn bandit."
Marklin nodded grimly.
"What about your dragon-sworn burning farms?"
a man's frightened voice shouted from the trees.
"They do be flaming bandits."
"What about your Aiel?"
another called.
"I do hear they carry off whole villages."
More voices from unseen men joined in, all shouting the same things. Dragon-sworn and Aiel, murderous brigands and savages. Rand ground his teeth. When the shouting faded, Narrowface said,
"You do see."
He paused to cough, then hawked and spat, maybe for his chest and maybe for emphasis. A pitiful sight, all wet and rust, but his backbone was as tight as his bowstring. He ignored Rand's glare as easily as he did Gregorin's.
"You do ask us to go home unarmed, unable to defend ourselves or our families, while your people do burn and steal and kill. They do say the storm be coming," he added,
and looked surprised that he had, surprised and confused for a moment.
"The Aiel you've heard about are my enemies!"
Not spiderwebs of flame this time, but solid sheets of fury that wrapped tight around the void. Rand's voice was ice, though. It roared like the crack of winter. The storm was coming? Light, he was the storm.
"My Aiel are hunting them down. My Aiel hunt the Shido, and they and Davram Bashir and most of the companions hunt bandits, whatever they call themselves. I am the king of Ilion, and I will allow no one to disrupt the peace of Ilion."
"Even if what you say do be true,"
Narrowface began.
"It is,"
Rand snapped.
"You have until midday to decide."
The man frowned uncertainly. Unless the roiling clouds cleared, he might have a difficult time knowing midday. Rand gave him no relief.
"Decide wisely," he said.
Whirling Tidashar about, he spurred the gelding to a gallop back toward the ridge without waiting for the others. Reluctantly, he let go of the power, forced himself not to hang on like a man clutching salvation with his fingernails as life and filth drained from him together. For an instant, he saw double. The world seemed to tilt dizzily. That was a recent problem, and he worried it might be part of the sickness that killed men who channeled, but the dizziness never lasted more than moments. It was the rest of letting go that he regretted. The world seemed to dull. No, it did dull, and became somehow less. Colors were washed out, the sky smaller, compared to what they had been before. He wanted desperately to seize the source again and wring the one power out of it. Always it was so when the power left him. No sooner had Sidene gone, though, than rage bubbled in its place, white hot and searing, nearly as hot as the power had been. The Seanchan were not enough, and brigands hiding behind his name? Deadly distractions he could not afford. Was Samael reaching out from the grave? Had he sown the Shido to sprout like thorns wherever Rand laid a hand? Why? The man could not have believed he would die. And if half the tales Rand heard were true, there were more in Murindi and Altara, and the Light alone knew where. Many among the Shido already taken prisoner had spoken of an Aes Sedai. Could the White Tower be involved somehow? Would the White Tower never give him peace? Never. Never. Battling fury, he was blind to Gregorin and the rest catching up. When they topped the ridge among the waiting nobles, he drew rein so abruptly that Tidashar reared, pawing the air and flinging mud from his hooves. The nobles edged their mounts back, from his gelding, from him. "I gave them to midday," he announced. "Watch them. I don't want this lot breaking into 50 smaller bands and slipping away. I'll be in my tent." Except for wind-tossed cloaks, they might have been stone, rooted to one spot as if he meant the command to watch for them personally. At that moment, he did not care if they stayed there till they froze or melted. Without another word, he trotted down the back slope of the ridge, followed by the two black-coated Ashaman and his Ilionar banner-bearers. Fire and ice and death was coming. But he was steel. He was steel. Chapter 14. Message from the Mahale. A mile west of the ridge, the camps began. Men and horses in cook fires, wind-flailed banners and a few scattered tents, clumped by nationality, by house. Each camp a lake of churned mud, separated from the others by stretches of brushy heath. Men mounted and afoot watched Rand's streaming banners pass and peered toward other camps to gauge reactions. When the Aiel had been present, these men had made a single, huge camp, driven together by one of the few things they truly shared in common. They were not Aiel, and feared them, however much they denied it. The world would die unless he succeeded, but he had no illusions that they shared any loyalty to him, or ever believed that the fate of the world could not be made to accommodate their own concerns, their own desires for gold or glory or power. A handful did, perhaps, a bare handful, but for the most part they followed because they feared him far more than they did the Aiel. Maybe more than they did the Dark One, in whom some did not really believe, not in the depths of their hearts, not that he could and would touch the world harder than he had already. Rand stood before their faces, and they believed in that. He accepted it, now. He had too many battles ahead of him to waste effort on one he could not win. So long as they followed and obeyed, it had to be enough. The largest of the camps was his own, and here Ilianar companions in green coats with yellow cuffs rubbed shoulders with Tyran defenders of the stone in fat-sleeved coats striped black and gold, and an equal number of Kariennin drawn from 40-odd houses in dark colors, some with Khan stiff above their heads. They cooked at different fires, slept apart, picketed their horses apart, and eyed one another warily, but they mingled. The safety of the Dragon Reborn was their responsibility, and they took the job seriously. Any of them might betray him, but not while the others were there to watch. Old hatreds and new dislikes would bring betrayal of any plot before the betrayer stopped to think. A ring of steel stood guard around Rand's tent, a huge, peaked thing of green silk embroidered all over with bees in thread of gold. It had belonged to his predecessor, Matin Stepanaeus, and had come with the crown, in a manner of speaking. Companions in burnished conical helmets stood side by side with defenders in helmets ridged and rimmed, and Kariennin in bell-shaped helms, ignoring the wind, barred face guards hiding their features, halberds slanted precisely. No one moved a hair when Rand drew rein, but a bevy of servants came running to attend to him and the Ashaman. A bony woman in the green and yellow vest of a groom from the royal palace in Ilion took his bridle, while his stirrup was held by a bulbous-nosed fellow in the black and gold livery of the Stone of Tyr. They tugged forelocks to him, and cast only one sharp look at one another. Barina Karavin, a stout, pale little woman in a dark dress, self-importantly offered him a silver tray of damp cloths from which steam rose. Kariennin, she watched the other two, though more as if making sure they did their tasks properly than with the animosity for each other they barely hid. But with care, still. What worked with the soldiers worked with the servants as well. Drawing off his gauntlets, Rand waved away Borina's tray. Damer Flynn had risen from an ornately carved bench in front of the tent as Rand dismounted. Bald, except for a ragged white fringe, Flynn looked more a grandfather than an Ashaman. A leather-tough grandfather with a stiff leg who had seen more of the world than a farm. The sword at his hip looked as if it belonged, as well it should on a former soldier of the Queen's Guard. Rand trusted him more than most. Flynn had saved his life, after all. Flynn saluted, fist to chest, and when Rand acknowledged him with a nod, limped closer and waited until the grooms left with the horses before speaking in a low voice.
"Torval's here. Sent by the Mahail, he says. He wanted to wait in the council tent. I told Narishma to watch him."
That had been Rand's command, though he was not sure why he had given it. No one who came from the Black Tower was to be left alone. Hesitating, Flynn fingered the dragon on his black collar.
"He wasn't happy to hear you'd raised all of us."
"Wasn't he now?" Rand said softly, tucking his gloves behind his sword belt. And because Flynn still looked uncertain, he added,
"You all earned it."
He had been about to send one of the Ashaman to Taim, the leader, the Mahail, as the Ashaman all called him. But now Torval could carry the message. In the council tent? "Have refreshments sent," he told Flynn, then motioned Hopwill and Dashiva to follow. Flynn saluted again, but Rand was already striding away, black mud squelching around his boots. No cheers rose for him in the blustering wind. He could recall when there had been. If that was not one of Luz Theron's memories, if Luz Theron had ever been real. A flash of color just beyond the edge of sight, the feel of someone about to touch him from behind. With an effort, he focused himself. The council tent was a large, red-striped pavilion that had once sat on the plains of Meredo, now pitched in the middle of Rand's encampment, surrounded by 30 paces of bare ground. There were never guards here, unless Rand was meeting with the nobles. Anyone trying to slip in would have been seen instantly by 1,000 prying eyes. 3 banners on tall poles formed a triangle around the tent, the rising sun of Carrion, the three crescents of Tyr, and the golden bees of Ilion. And above the crimson roof, higher than the rest, stood the dragon banner and the banner of light. The wind made them all stand out, rippling and snapping, and the tent walls shivered in the gusts. Inside, colorful fringed carpets made a floor, and the only furniture was a huge table, thickly carved and gilded, inlaid with ivory and turquoise. A jumble of maps almost hid the tabletop. Torval lifted his head from the maps, plainly ready to give the rough side of his tongue to whoever had barged in on him. Close to his middle years and tall beside anyone save Rand or Nihil, he stared coldly down a sharp nose that practically quivered with indignation. The dragon and the sword glistened on his coat collar in the light of the stand lamps. A silk coat, shining black, cut fine enough for a lord. His sword had silver mountings washed with gold, and a glittering red gem capped the hilt. Another gleamed darkly on a finger ring. You could not train men to be weapons without expecting a certain amount of arrogance, yet Rand did not like Torval. But then he had no need of Luz Theron's voice to be suspicious of any man in a black coat. How far did he truly trust even Flynn? Yet he had to lead them. The Ashaman were his making, his responsibility. When Torval saw Rand, he straightened casually and saluted, but his expression barely changed. He had had a sneering mouth the first time Rand ever saw him. "My lord dragon," he said in the accents of Terabon, and he might have been greeting an equal, or being gracious to an inferior. His swaggering bow took in Hopal and Ashiva as well. "I give congratulations on the conquest of Ilion. A great victory, yes? There would have been wine to greet you, but this young dedicated does not seem to understand orders." In the corner, silver bells on the ends of Narishma's two long dark braids made a faint sound as he shifted. He had tanned darkly in the southern sun, but some things about him had not changed. Older than Rand, his face made him seem younger than Hopwill, but the red that rose in his cheeks was anger, not embarrassment. His pride in the new one's sword on his collar was quiet, yet deep. Torval smiled at him, a slow smile, both amused and dangerous. Dashiva laughed, a short bark, and was still. "What are you doing here, Torval?" Rand asked roughly.